You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 9th of February 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. A very warm welcome from me, Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's programme, while President Biden takes a lead on Ukraine, the US Secretary of State heads to Australia to shore up support and affirm his country's focus on Asia. We'll look at what he can achieve and what message this sends to China. Also ahead, Hong Kong turns the clocks back on COVID restrictions with a fresh lockdown. Our Bureau Chief James Chambers will bring us the latest. Plus, Israel will hold an inquiry into claims that the police used the powerful Pegasus spyware against public figures. We'll ask what it may uncover. All that, plus the papers and the Oscar nominations.
Open up the gate, let him out.
You sure he's not ready?
Go on, let him out.
It's just a man.
The film expert Karen Krasanovich will join me in the studio to go through the favourites and those who missed the spot. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. So, a look at what else is happening in today's news. The French President Emmanuel Macron says Russia's President Vladimir Putin has assured him Russian forces will not escalate the crisis near Ukraine's border. Canada's busiest border crossing has reopened after protesting truckers ground traffic to a standstill. And thousands of people have demonstrated in the Argentinian capital Buenos Aires against a deal with the International Monetary Fund to reschedule a $40 billion debt the country cannot pay back. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, departing Washington for an important trip to the Indo-Pacific region. Looking forward to productive meetings with leaders and communities to promote our shared values and to advance our goals. So said the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken as he departed for Australia yesterday. His visit comes at a time when the US has a lot on its plate, with the focus so much on handling Russia and a potential invasion of Ukraine. What will this trip do by Mr. Blinken to shore up support against Washington's other great rival, China? Well, Karen Middleton is the Saturday Paper's chief political correspondent in Canberra, and I'm delighted to say she joins me now. Karen, good afternoon. There is a big job ahead here for Secretary Blinken. Let's focus on the Quad, Australia, India, Japan, United States, all meeting. What's on the agenda?
It's got a long agenda. Funnily enough, none of it specifically mentions China, but you can assume that China particularly, and then relations between China and Russia, and then the activities of those regimes in other parts of the world are certainly high on the agenda. You've got to remember this organisation, the Quad, was really set up with China in mind. They don't like to say that either, but it's a foil, I suppose, to the exertions of power that China has been making in this region of the world. So it's the four big powers that have interests in this region. So they're going to be talking about things like vaccine distribution around the region, cyber space and critical technology, countering sort of disinformation campaigns, malicious cyber activity, counterterrorism, maritime security, climate change, all the likes of that. But you can be sure they will also talk about what's happening between Russia and Ukraine, and also any ties that people are seeing, growing connections between Russia and China.
It's an astonishing list that they've got to get through. Is there any sense of what they are likely to achieve with all this?
Well, it's a bit hard to know exactly what specifics they're aiming at. I know that there's concern about distribution of vaccines around this region because, of course, everybody who has anything to do with trying to address the COVID-19 pandemic emphasises that until we're all safe, none of us are safe. So there's a big drive to make sure that some of the less well-off countries in the Indo-Pacific have access to vaccines and are properly vaccinated. So I'm sure that will be high on the list. But they're certainly concerned also about the activity of regimes that might be seen as having ideas that run counter to the ideas of liberal democracy. And their Foreign Minister of Australia, Maurice Payne, has been on radio here today talking about the concerns that these governments have watching the events between Russia and Ukraine, for example, and that these other major powers might have an idea of the global world order that doesn't equate to the ideas that these liberal democracies have. So in the big picture sense, that will be quite high on their agenda.
What Blinken, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, was saying as he departed for Australia was that he wanted to make sure that this trip to the Indo-Pacific would promote our shared values and advance our goals. Is there occasionally the sense that the United States doesn't pay enough attention to this part of the world, not least because it's preoccupied with Ukraine, but also because this is such an important part of the world for the US?
I think there's been a long-standing anxiety in this part of the world, particularly on the part of successive Australian governments, that the United States might lose interest in this part of the world. They're seen as by many as a stabilising force in terms of just keeping an interest in being a presence that other countries can call on. Certainly under the presidency of Donald Trump, there was a feeling that the United States was losing interest in pulling away from the region, compared, say, to when Barack Obama was in office and there was talk of the pivot to Asia. So I think the countries of the region are mostly anyway keen for the US to remain engaged, and the Quad is one of the newer vehicles for that to occur.
Tell us a little bit about what China's reaction is going to be about this. Because if you look about it, the Quad does not see itself as a military alliance, but China will notice that you've got four very powerful democracies here, all with a very strong maritime presence, very, very powerful in terms of the military. What is Beijing going to do how is Beijing going to see this?
Well, it's interesting how they will react in public. There might be a difference between their public and private reactions. Certainly relations between the Chinese and the Australian governments are at a low ebb and have been for some years. They've been openly hostile, the Chinese and the Australian governments, to each other. We've seen effective trade sanctions against Australia. They didn't like China didn't like what Australia was doing in trying to attack what they saw as malicious cyber activity and that China was being blamed for. So, you know, for a start, the host of the Quad is not China's favourite country right now, and I'm sure that they will see these meetings within a security frame. They will be looking to what these countries are proposing in the South China Sea and in the region, and these countries no doubt have concern about China's ambitions. So I think China will be, if not openly hostile, then certainly suspicious of what these gatherings are really about.
Tell me how this is playing out domestically in Australia, with Scott Morrison's popularity levels the lowest that they possibly could be, given the last few months and years. How is it being played out?
Well, we haven't had the sort of fanfare of the arrivals of these ministers yet, but I'm sure the government will be keen to emphasise the role that these visitors will play in our national security. The Conservative government that we have in office now prides itself on having a good record on national security in a political sense. It reputationally has been seen as being stronger on national security than the Labor challenger, the Labor opposition. So I'm sure, given we're approaching a federal election, the government will be seeking to do all that it can to be able to use this kind of an event to emphasise its own credentials to its domestic political audience. Whether it ends up playing out in any bigger sense to the domestic audience in relation to China is unclear, but certainly our government here hasn't been reluctant to make open and quite strident criticisms of China. So that may well be the case when the Quad gets underway.
Karen Middleton from the Saturday Paper, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. 15:09 in Hong Kong, 7:09 here in London. You're with The Globalist. Any hopes of Hong Kong opening up to a post-COVID world have been dashed by the announcement that the city is to go once more into lockdown. The new rules, which come into force, will make it difficult to socialise at home, to send kids to school, to gather in restaurants and to live inside a city that's been shut off to the outside world for almost 2 years now. Well, James Chambers is Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Good morning. Good afternoon, James.
Good morning, Emma. So, I'm still able to go to the office.
I'm absolutely overjoyed to hear that, because it means that we can talk about what's going on in Hong Kong, or rather, what isn't. This is another big lockdown, isn't it? Tell us what it involves.
Well, the Omicron variant of COVID-19 finally arrived in Hong Kong late last year. And during the first few weeks of this year, it seemed like the government and the authorities could keep a lid on it with the very strict provisions that are already in place. But over the last week, it's been ticking up. And we had about 600 cases yesterday, and there's probably going to be about 1,000, over 1,000 today, which is not a lot in comparison to places like, you know, the UK or the US, a big city like London. But in Hong Kong, it's, you know, over 1,000 cases per day is unprecedented. And it's, you know, freaking a lot of people out. But I guess the problem is there's still a fixation with that headline figure. I mean, there's no discussion about what is happening to those people who get Omicron. And yesterday we heard from the chief executive, Carrie Lam, about the, I guess, the latest strategy and how her government was going to handle it. And I guess what, to summarize, what went on, it seems like it's been a bit of a return to the dark days of 2020. We do really feel like we've gone back 2 years, and we're right at the very start of this, when, you know, when it was this scary virus that no one knew how to handle. You know, they've now, in another unprecedented move, stopped limited gathering inside people's homes. So only two households can gather together at home. And that's the first time that the government has ever interfered in the private sphere. They've always left homes and offices out of anything that they've tried to do. So, you know, in a way, it's actually the strictest it's ever been.
And what's been the reaction to this? Because there is a certain world weariness when you go not into lockdown once, twice or three times, but this is just coming back again and again for Hong Kong, isn't it?
That's right. And I think there's a number of views. A lot of, you know, Hong Kongers are still very afraid of this virus, and they're willing to do their part, you know, to try and defeat it, to try and fight it. It's very much being framed as a battle still, like it was, you know, back in 2020. And the queues to get, you know, to get tested around the block. I live quite close to a testing centre, and so every day I see these queues getting longer and longer. So I don't think there's any urgent need or demand from locals here to change anything. I think they definitely want to get it down to zero again. But when it comes to a lot of the business people who need to travel, a lot of the foreigners here, I mean, they were hoping that with Omicron being, you know, not deadly like previous mutations, then it would be a chance for Hong Kong to chart a course out of this. And the fact that these cases looked like they were getting out of control might have given the government a chance to rethink their strategy. But as we found out yesterday, that's not going to be the case. So, you know, as you mentioned at the start, a lot of, you know, business people and foreigners here have kind of lost all hope of anything changing in the next, certainly not the next year, and perhaps the next 2 years.
How much of a lost opportunity is this for Hong Kong?
I think it's a huge missed opportunity, because, you know, it should be said that over the last 2 years, 2020 and 2021, Hong Kong did a very good job of, you know, keeping its citizens safe. It had a very clear strategy that, you know, we're going to, you know, fight the virus, keep it out of Hong Kong, keep everyone safe. And they did it. They did it very well. And it was a very safe place to live for locals and for foreigners when we were watching what was going on around the world. But, you know, the problem is the government is unable to adapt to the new realities we face. And so we seem to be stuck fighting a battle with strategies from 2020, rather than updating them for Omicron and for the future. So I think this was one of those opportunities where the government had a real chance to actually say, you know, this is different. Omicron is a different kind of virus, and it'll take a different approach. And we do need to open up. And there was some momentum building. There was even some kind of criticism coming from some of the papers here. There was a property tycoon who came out and actually called for the government to change its strategy. That was a few weeks ago. And that's, you don't really get that unless either his opinion has already been cleared by the government, or he feels fairly confident that a change is in the air. So, you know, that was giving a lot of us here a bit of confidence that something was going to change, and that the population here was being prepped for a kind of move towards living with the virus. But I guess, you know, yesterday that door was slammed shut, and the chief executive confirmed that, you know, we're sticking with zero COVID.
One thing that has been noticed, though, is that the cumulative effect in the last few years of the crackdown against people, freedom of speech, Beijing exerting ever more strongly its authority, and now this sense that Hong Kong is a city which locks down as opposed to adapt. People are now leaving in their droves, aren't they?
That's true. This exodus is definitely underway. I'd say we're seeing the start of it, and it's going to snowball in the next few months. People are leaving, I'd say, more because of the pandemic and the quarantines, and the fact we haven't been able to leave for 2 years and see family all over the world, rather than the national security law itself. But the two are entwined. I think one of the effects of the protests and the national security law is that Beijing has essentially taken more control of the city and is having a more of a direct say in policy. Now, that means that our COVID strategy, our decision to stick with zero COVID, is not necessarily being made by the local government here. It is something that's being sent down from Beijing. And so Hong Kong, even though it's meant to have a high degree of autonomy, is no longer able to go its own way. It can't make that decision to open up to the international world. That has to be made in Beijing. So the two are linked, and we, you know, the government here just has to wait until Beijing is ready to allow it to move. And, you know, we, all the foreigners, all the business people who live here, we know that. We know nothing's going to change here until it changes in China. And so people have started making plans. Chinese New Year last week, a lot of people get together, have food. And, the main topic of conversation is, you know, who's leaving and where are you going? I know people in the last few weeks in all kinds of sectors who are leaving. You know, Russian tech companies, British chefs. We've got Korean bankers, people who work for European football leagues like the Premier League and or the NBA. All of these industries are leaving Hong Kong, and they're a lot of them do seem to be heading to Singapore. And while, you know, people will come back, while expats will return, younger ones, newer ones, to Hong Kong in the future, I just fear those same jobs won't be here. There'll still be demand for people in finance, for bankers and brokers who want to serve the mainland market. But that whole kind of international feel to Hong Kong, the thing that really has made this city unique, is at risk of leaving.
James Chambers, thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist. Still to come on today's programme, we hear from Estonia's former foreign minister, and we take a look at the Oscar nominations as The Power of the Dog leads away with 12.
Open up the gate, let him out.
You sure he's not ready?
Go on, let him out.
It's just a man, Peter.
Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now, 9:19 in Athens, 7:19 here in London. Now, an inquiry is to be held into claims that Israel's police force used the powerful Pegasus spyware to target dozens of public figures, including the son of the former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The inquiry into the police's behaviour will be held at cabinet level, but conducted, we understand, by the police. Well, joining me now from Tel Aviv is Alison Kaplan-Sommer, a journalist for Harrods and a regular voice on Monocle 24. Good morning, Alison.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Just explain to us, please, what the Pegasus spyware tool was used for.
Well, according to media reports, this is all part of sort of an explosive expose in a newspaper called the Calculist business publication. According to the report, it was used extensively to infiltrate the telephones of numerous public figures, including mayors, including the director generals of several ministries, including activists who were planning protests. There were activists for the disabled who blocked roads, and Ethiopian Israelis who were protesting blocked roads, presumably to get information on what their future plans were. And kind of most controversially, there's allegations that they were used to infiltrate the phones of key witnesses in the trial of former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which has really turned that trial, which is already, you know, very controversial on its ear.
This had all come out from an Israeli media outlet, hadn't it, that had done their homework. How did this all come to light?
Well, I mean, as we know, the background is that this Pegasus spyware has been used all over the world. This company, NSO, has sold it to many regimes, both dictatorships and democracies, where it's been used. It's marketed as a tool to fight crime and terror, but we're finding that a lot of regimes are using it in order to investigate their enemies and are not using it well. And there have been major international investigations. And somehow Israelis thought they were immune to it, or they thought, you know, this is only for export, or, you know, in radical cases used to try to infiltrate the phones of potential terrorists. So Israelis have been stunned by these allegations and revelations that police have been using it to investigate citizens who have not been charged with crimes or not even seriously suspected of crimes. And, you know, in violation of Israeli law, which has very strict guidelines for, you know, how much court authorization is necessary in order to get access to people's private communications.
Tell us a little bit now about the inquiry and who's leading it and what it's intended to achieve.
Well, that's, you know, that's the controversy right now. The police are obviously investigating themselves, and many lawmakers are not satisfied with that, and they are pressing for an independent investigation, which would be, you know, led by a retired judge or some sort of independent authority figure. And there's so little trust in the system, and particularly in the police and the legal establishment, that many politicians are saying we can't trust them to investigate themselves.
So tell us a little bit more about how this investigation is going to be carried out then. I mean, there is this huge scandal about the fact that at the end of the police are effectively marking their own homework. But what form will the inquiry take? What form will the investigation take? And what exactly are they trying to find out? Are they trying to find out who commissioned this, how it was allowed to happen? What's the context?
Well, exactly. I mean, as you know, Israel has had four elections in the past 2 years, and we've had this rotation of justice ministers. We've had numerous chiefs of police. So there's a lot of finger pointing and, passing the hat in terms of who's responsible for this. So a thorough investigation would definitely get to the heart of who authorized, presuming that these reports are accurate, who authorized this extensive use of this tool, you know, which seems, if the story is correct, was used, you know, on a much more routine basis than this kind of spyware should be used domestically on citizens. So, you know, exactly how it's going to unfold, I think, is yet to be determined. But if the level of public outrage is any measure, then I think that we're going going to see, it won't be resolved unless there's some sort of independent commission of inquiry, which will probably be appointed by the Knesset. And the goal will definitely be to see, you know, how this came to happen and who authorized it, who's responsible, and then who should pay the price.
You mentioned the fact that this could actually affect the trial of Benjamin Netanyahu. In what way will that happen?
Well, if the key witnesses in the trial were had their phones infiltrated, hacked, if information key to the trial and key to the charges and the allegations against Netanyahu was obtained illegitimately, illegally, you know, this could throw the whole proceedings into question, and you know, and that's only a symbol. This trial is only a symbol of any other legal procedures in which there's any kind of basis for suspecting that that the spyware has been used in order to gather evidence against the person who is accused.
Tell me a little bit more about what this means for Israel's reputation in the world. I mean, the fact is you have this company NSO, which created Pegasus, sells it to authoritarian governments who then go and use it to hack the phones of activists. It's got to the point that the Biden administration has blacklisted NSO, saying it supplies spyware to maliciously target dissidents. Israel has a reputation of being militarily and technologically absolutely brilliant. What does this do in terms of, you know, tarnishing that reputation?
Well, you know, there's been a sense that NSO is on its way down because, as you said, the Biden administration is taking this strong position against it. There's also been action in Europe recently in terms of blacklisting NSO and saying that, you know, we're not only, you know, should we not buy their product, but we shouldn't supply to them in any possible way. So with the amount of bad will against NSO, there's a sense that there's really now a limit to how far that they can go in terms of a business, and that they may be heading downhill. And so some are theorizing that that these leaks about the use of its spyware may be coming from, you know, embittered ex-NSO employees or current NSO employees, you know, wanting to bring everyone down with them. If they're going down, then they're going to go down as well. But, you know, others, you know, frame it in a way of, you know, it's the same as, you know, selling terrible weaponry to other countries, that it's, you know, it's just another form of weapons dealing and weapons trading, you know, for better and for worse. And, you know, it would be the same, I guess, as if countries that sell weapons to another country that are being used on hapless civilians instead of in legitimate warfare.
There is this irony, isn't there, that's been brought to light, the fact that the opposition and people who say that, you know, Israel's been using the likes of Pegasus against Palestinians for years and years and years, there is an irony now that people are saying that it's come back to roost within Israeli society.
Yes, and, you know, others, I mean, maybe the more cynical or you could say realistic among them can say, how could you even imagine that the authorities would have these kind of powerful tools in their hands and not use them to their advantage, you know, in every possible situation, not only against Palestinians and not only against, you know, criminals. We've got some very difficult organized crime problem in the country. And so there would be public support for using those tools against organized crime. But again, you know, many are not necessarily surprised that that they've been used above and beyond their original intention.
Alison Kaplan-Sommer, thank you so much for joining us on the line in Israel Now. The time is just coming up to 7:29 here in London. In a moment, we'll be hearing from the former foreign minister of Estonia to find out whether she is worried about what could happen on her borders. But first, let's have a look at the latest world headlines. The French President Emmanuel Macron says Russia's President Vladimir Putin has assured him that Russian forces won't escalate the crisis near Ukraine's border. However, Russia has said any suggestion of a guarantee was not right. Russia has assembled more than 100,000 troops near to the Ukrainian border, but has denied any plans to invade. Canada's busiest border crossing has reopened after protesting truckers ground traffic to a standstill. Truckers rallying against Canada's COVID vaccination rules had blocked the Ambassador Bridge on Monday night. side, forcing vehicles to take long detours. Protesters had forced authorities to close it just hours after the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had accused the demonstrators of attempting to blockade our economy. And thousands of people have protested in the Argentinian capital of Buenos Aires against a deal with the International Monetary Fund to reschedule a $40 billion debt the country cannot pay back. The protesters paraded through the capital with banners saying no to paying the IMF. And those are the headlines on The Globalist. We'll be heading to Zurich in just a moment to go through the newspapers with Monocle security correspondent Benno Zog. But first, as various Western leaders descend on Moscow and Kiev this week to try to calm tensions with Russia, neighbouring Baltic states are seeking NATO support. Indeed, while most of the Western world regards the current Russian threat as a flare-up, some countries have had to regard Russia as a constant. Earlier, Monocle's Tom Edwards heard from Marina Kaljurand, who's Estonia's former foreign minister. Marina also served as her country's ambassador to six countries, including Russia, the US, Israel, Canada, Mexico and Kazakhstan. Tom began by asking her whether she was worried that a similar crisis might one day occur in Estonia.
First of all, I'd like to make it very clear that things like in Ukraine cannot happen in the Baltics or in Eastern Europe. We are members of EU and NATO. That's a huge difference. And so that's why, yes, the question is sometimes asked, but there is no parallel between what's happening in Ukraine, what's happened in Georgia, what's happened in Crimea, and what might happen in Estonia.
Well, I guess given that, did Estonia ever consider taking a more neutral approach strategically, you know, like, I don't know, Finland or Sweden? Or do you think there has always been not just an acknowledgement, but a fundamental understanding that NATO membership is in and of itself critical?
We learned our lesson in 1940. Until 1940, from 1918 to 1940, Estonia was an independent country. And the country then tried to be, if I do not say neutral, then at least not interfering, having good relations with everybody, trying to survive. But if you look at our geopolitical location, we learned our lesson in 1940 when we were occupied. So when we regained independence in 1991, it was clear that we will not survive being an independent state without being with allies and partners. And for us, there is no other way than to be part of NATO and to be part of the EU.
At the risk of asking you a question which it's impossible to answer, do you think that Russia has designs on the Baltic states? Or is the critical point exactly as you already made, Marina, which is that Putin is maybe more interested in challenging the cohesiveness, the unity of NATO, in fact?
Yes, you're right. I do not know the plans. I don't know what's inside the head of Putin. I don't know how many people at all know that. So I agree with those who say that he does not have a concrete plan yet. And he decides what to do, or let's say he has several plans, and he's just looking into which plan to pick up. Are there any plans to destabilize the situation in Estonia? I do not exclude that. Being ambassador to Russia in my previous life and being Estonian foreign minister in my previous life, I've seen the militarization, I've seen the rhetoric, I've seen unpredictability, and that's why I do not exclude any scenarios, but occupation and fighting and attack, military attack against Estonia or the Baltics, I don't think it will happen.
Marina, I want to ask you a little bit about your experience when you were foreign minister. What was the nature of the relationship that you were able to forge with your counterpart in Moscow? Was it how would you characterize the working relationship, if you like, that you had at the time?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I've been Estonian ambassador to six countries altogether: Russia, Israel, United States, Canada, Mexico, and Kazakhstan. And trust me, these are all very different experiences. Can I be a friend with a Russian diplomat? I don't think so. Yes, we can talk. We can talk sometimes very openly. We can talk about our personal thinkings, but we always remember, or at least I always remember, because I'm not posted to a country which policy is friendly towards mine. When I was posted to Russia, I had to be careful of all my moves, everything I said, where I went, with whom I talked, and so on. But at the same time, it was as interesting posting as in Washington. As to my relations with Foreign Minister Lavrov, we had relations already when I was ambassador to Russia. So when I became foreign minister, I think it was easier we knew each other to some extent. And we had our last meeting, which was also the last Estonian foreign minister's meeting with Russian foreign minister in September 2016 in New York, in the margins of the UN General Assembly. We had our talking points. We did the usual stuff. We discussed the points we always have on agenda. From Russian side, it's the violation of human rights of Russians in Estonia. It's all the bad things that Estonia is doing, why Estonia is so Russia-phobic, and so on and so on. From my side, it's always the human rights situation in Russia. It's the situation of civil society in Russia, and so on. And then we went to the topics where we can cooperate together, being it cross-border cooperation, because we are neighboring countries, and we do have several cross-border projects. So yes, the usual topics, but I think that we were not naive about the meeting.
That was Estonia's former Foreign Minister Marina Kaljurand speaking to Monocle's Tom Edwards. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. It's 8:35 in Zurich, so let's head to Dufourstrasse 90 to have a look at today's newspapers. And I'm delighted to say Benno Zog, Monocle's security correspondent and a researcher at the Centre for Security Studies at ETH Zurich, is standing by with a coffee ready. How's life in Zurich, Benno?
Life is quite all right. Good morning, Emma.
Nice to have you with us. Just listening to what Marina Kaljurand was talking about there with the Estonian former foreign minister, talking about Russia being a constant in everything that she has done diplomatically. It's an enormous task, isn't it, if you're a neighbour?
Indeed, it's incredible, and particularly given Estonia's history, but also she referred to 1940, for example, the Soviet invasion or annexation of Estonia, which had a very short period of independence back then. But ever since, even, there's a sizable Russian minority, for example, in Estonia, up to a third of the population or so. So there's always been this threat of also internal divisions that Russia may exploit, and this kind of meddling that we see in all kinds of countries, and obviously a parallel with Ukraine as well, which also has this population that is somewhat susceptible to Russian influence. And then this tiny country, Estonia, of course, just about more than a million inhabitants, being so close to this giant neighbor that's invaded before. It must be very present, this Russia topic, in any kind of foreign policy issue. But it's striking how Estonia has fared. It's fared really well. Its course towards the West was never disputed, not even by Russia. So them joining the EU, NATO, came as no surprise, and Russia didn't even object. So that's quite a success story in a way.
And that way that Marina Kaljurand approaches the relationship with Russia, there's a sort of not necessarily a world weariness about it, but there's a wisdom to what she says, isn't there? I mean, there's no sense of naivety.
Absolutely. You actually hear similar statements from the likes of Finland, for example, which also has this very, very long history of dealing with this enormously more powerful and very present neighbour, and actually being very frank about it, because one cannot be naive. Otherwise, the history of these countries would have ended. There were wars between the two so many times in history, both recent and ancient. So also when she talks about Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov, for example, it's with this long experience that she personally has, but also that her country has, as in they know exactly who they're opposing, who's at the other end of the table, how to deal with them, and probably the same way around for the Russians, which have dealt with the likes of Estonia and Finland and so on for a long time. So there's a bit of an understanding and a frankness at the table, I think. And I can really sense that from the interview as well.
Let's continue with Ukraine, but look at more the level of interest actually from other countries. Very much we see Joe Biden leading from the front, but the Washington Post has to explain why Ukraine is actually indeed America's problem.
Indeed, it's to be very clear, it's an op-ed in the Washington Post that deals with, well, the title already is, Why is Ukraine Our Problem? Well, fair enough. It starts with surveys that a majority of American citizens actually support sanctions against Russia in the case of an invasion. Half of them support the additional deployment of US troops in Ukraine. But the article goes on, there's also quite a large share that isn't sure or doesn't know how to answer. And I think that's a very important point, because Ukraine to them feels very far away, and it's in Europe. So why should not Europe deal with it? I also wonder whether some who do support additional support to Ukraine even know where to find Ukraine on the map. So there may be a bit of a disconnect there. But in the end, the article boils down to the question of why should the US care? And it states that it should care because others are watching. If the US doesn't show resolve in Ukraine, China may invade in Taiwan, North Korea or Iran may get nuclear weapons, and so on. So that this is kind of a test of American resolve. And we hear that all over certain articles, particularly in the US, which can be very inward-looking, this testing American resolve in all kinds of contexts. And it's an interesting trope, but it's also probably a bit dangerous to see the world through that lens.
It's a difficult situation that the United States finds itself in, though, given the disastrous withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan last August. And at that point, a line was very firmly drawn by the Biden administration under an episode which then said, look, the lesson learned we have here is that we do not get involved in other people's problems.
Absolutely. In a way, you could argue exactly that, which would mean that the US should probably retreat from the Ukrainian context and leave more room to the Europeans to get their act together, which is part of the logic. It's always been the two, as in Europeans on a context like Ukraine, but maybe even on Afghanistan and others, should take more responsibility, and the US will not lead from behind, but to some extent still be there as a guarantor, but not get too involved. It's actually quite remarkable, if you think about it, that Joe Biden or State Secretary Blinken keep traveling to the context, to the region, and invest so much time in that. Because the long-term threats strategically to the Americans are, of course, China and the Indo-Pacific as a region. So this American investment is really impressive these days, but it cannot be upheld forever. So there's a tension there.
Let's move on to a lack of tension. If you are European and you want to forward science, there has been this huge thing, hasn't there, in the last couple of years, not least because of Brexit, about how involved various countries should get when it comes to scientific development. Scientists do not respect borders. Science itself does not respect borders, does it? So we have this new problem that we're dealing with, and that's covered in the NZZ today.
Absolutely. It's actually across the Swiss press because we're quite concerned. It's probably less present in the UK press. But it's these two countries, these two major non-EU members, which have a very strong educational sector, strong universities. 9 out of 10 of the best European universities are in either the UK or Switzerland. One of them, by the way, is my very own ETH in Zurich that I work for. But there's this huge pot of funds, 100 billion euros over 7 years. It's probably the biggest public research fund in the world of that kind, that they don't have access to, or not that easily, because both the UK and Switzerland and all its researchers based here of whatever nationality are kind of barred for political reasons from participating. And countries are in complicated negotiations of how to participate, because as you say, Emma, science knows no border. It's all about multinational big projects in research. And if two countries are out, if some of their nationals cannot lead certain projects or are excluded from certain strategic sectors like aerospace entirely, then how to continue? So heads of universities and others have urged their governments to negotiate and have access to that.
Because absolutely everybody loses out, in other words, if it doesn't work, doesn't it?
Exactly that. It's also why hundreds of scientists from EU countries, Germany and the like, have signed this kind of petition as well, saying exactly that. We need multinational cooperation. It cannot just be within EU borders. We need third states that are so close geographically in terms of political systems and so on to participate. Because yes, everyone loses. And it's very, very hard to replace such a fund like Horizon Europe with its 100 billion. Switzerland is trying that with, like, the government provided 400 million or so to replace these funds that Switzerland doesn't have access to. But that's just not the same as being part of this, at this one table, being able to compete for these very big projects, some of them may cost billion over the course of decades or so. So yeah, it's really a lose-lose. And the article in NZZ ends with a pledge by one of these university directors to turn this into a win-win. It can be quite easy, but yeah, political reasons.
Finally, briefly, Benno, Croatia adopts the euro next year. Lovely. They've been running a competition to design the euro coin. Lovely. Hasn't gone so well, has it?
It has not. Who would have thought that when it comes to the design of a coin, as you know, the back of the coin is not generic, each country designs its own, there's plagiarism involved. So the artist that actually won the competition in Croatia and won a prize money of 10,000 euros or so, apparently plagiarized a photo of a British nature photographer. So the picture is actually of a marten, so this weasel-like animal, which is symbolic for Croatia and also gave the name to the old currency of the country. But it looks like he just Googled a photo of a marten and then tweaked tiny bits to make it look feasible for a coin and then entered the competition. And now, obviously, he had to withdraw and we will probably see something else on Croatia's euro coins.
Ben Ozog, thank you so much for joining us from around the table at Dufourstrasse 90. You're listening to The Globalist. We're live on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
...8:46 in Berlin, 7:46 here in London. Let's talk business now with Rachel Pupazzoni. He's a national business reporter and presenter at ABC News. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Emma.
Good to have you with us again. Good news for Australia. It's about to reopen to the world. We're all allowed to go on holiday there again. The business world must be absolutely ecstatic.
I think we all are, actually, because it means we can also leave the country, which is obviously a big thing for a lot of people, particularly those with business, as you say, and families internationally. And of course, people who are Australians and family members overseas who want to come here. But the main thing is, yes, we are now about to be open for business finally on February 21. You and your listeners may recall or may not, it was back in 2020 when we first learned about COVID in March of that year that our Prime Minister Scott Morrison pulled the gates up and shut the border to the rest of the world. So we're all very excited to be welcoming people back to our country. There are some rules, though. Anybody who does want to come into Australia must have 2 doses of the vaccine. There were some questions of the government this week whether that would be increased to 3 with the booster obviously gaining popularity in Australia and around the world, but at this stage just 2 doses. Anyone who's not vaccinated can apply for an exemption, but they'll be subjected to 14 days quarantine. We have already been open to some of our neighbours in the region to some limited travel already, Emma. That's New Zealand, Singapore, South Korea and Japan. But now we will be open to everybody. So it's good news for our tourism sector. A third of our tourists come from China and New Zealand. The UK makes up 8% of our visitors. So a lot of tourism operators very excited about what this year will hopefully deliver them.
Because the effects of the lockdown have... you can't underestimate how badly they've been affecting the travel industry. And there's this article on ABC's website where you have graphs which have airline passenger movements, domestic airline passenger movements, total airline passenger movements, and indeed overseas arrivals and departures. And you have a constant growth right up until the beginning of 2020, and then the drop is vertical, and it hasn't, and it's just flatlined, hasn't it? I mean, how badly hit have the airlines and the travel industry been in Australia?
Oh, you cannot underestimate it, as you say, Emma. A lot of our tourism operators absolutely depend on international tourists. Some of them, 90% of their revenue comes from international tourists. So there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of businesses that have just shut up shop. They cannot and have not been able to operate without those people visiting from as I say, China, one of our biggest countries of visitors, but all over the world. Airlines have laid off tens of thousands of staff over the last 2 years. The ramifications have been widespread, and it's really, you know, while we're all very excited, I think a lot of people in the industry are not expecting this massive bounce back. If you look at what happened after September 11, the global financial crisis, obviously similar sort of big global things that we can compare to, it took about a decade for international travel to recover to what it was before those events. So if you go on the sort of historical data, we could be facing many, many years ahead before airlines, tourism businesses are back to making the kind of money that they used to before 2020.
One thing that is doing brilliant business for New Zealand and Australia, New Zealand in particular, is the cinema. In a minute, we're going to be going through all the Oscar nominations with Karen Krasanovich. But first, from your perspective, Rachel, when you have someone like Jane Campion being nominated for an Academy Award for the second time, what does this do for New Zealand's film business?
Oh, well, New Zealand's film business is absolutely a huge sector in that country. You know, I think of all of the Lord of the Rings franchise films, and Australia obviously also trying to really grow its sector. I think one of the first well-known COVID cases here was actually Tom Hanks when he was in Queensland filming an Elvis Presley film directed by Baz Luhrmann. But a lot of people really rallying behind Jane Campion. As you say, she's just been given her second director nomination. She's the first woman director to receive two nominations for an Academy Award. So great news for her. This is for her film called Power of the Dog, which is a country western psychological drama. I haven't seen it myself, but I think that's what I'll be doing tonight, Emma. Jane Campion's first Oscar nomination for director was in 1994 for her film The Piano. Beautiful sweeping landscapes in that film, which really, I guess, bring the landscape of Australia and New Zealand to the world and really expose it to so many more viewers. And we're so proud of our region, and I think this notoriety that she's been able to gain 12 years since her last film, I understand, for the region is great news for film buffs, but for people who are so proud of this part of the world as well.
Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. Now, the Oscar nominations came out yesterday. To go through them, joining me in the studio, still with your mask on, Karen.
There.
Off it goes. Uh-huh. Wonderful. It's Karen Krasanovich. Welcome back, Karen.
It's lovely to be here.
Okay, so let's... who's looking good at the moment in terms of Oscar nominations?
It's such a big day yesterday.
It is.
It's like your birthday.
Wait, it was exciting, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really exciting.
Everyone was back. And back with a capital B.
Yes, 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 yes. And people are going back to the movies and people are taking interest and they're going, hey, wait a minute, I haven't seen Drive My Car, but it's 3 hours. Do I have to see it? Yes, you do. Right. So it looks like Power of the Dog, which is on Netflix, much to the consternation of exhibitors, is up for lots and lots and lots of things. And if you haven't seen it, watch it. I didn't like it the first time. I loved it the second time.
Why?
I don't know. I got the story arc a little bit more. I expected it to be a little bit different. And in a way, I found it a little predictable. But the performances are amazing. Cinematography is lovely. The story is beguiling. And Eri Wegner was the first female cinematographer, Power of the Dog, nominated, which is, you know, you look at it and you think, this is just a beautiful film.
And as we were just hearing a moment ago from Rachel Papazzoni, a huge coup for Jane Campion.
Yeah, yeah, really good. She'll be the only female director to have won two Oscars if she wins this. Also, what I think is interesting, if we're talking about Australia. Were we talking about Australia, New Zealand?
Yes.
Jenny Bevan is down there right now working on the sequel to Mad Max. And she is up for an Oscar for Cruella. for the costumes in Cruella. And even though it's a really strong year for costumes, sorry to be slipping right into costumes, but ignoring all the actors, you know, she is such a creative force. And I think she's going to win. I hope so.
Good. Lovely. Right. Let's go back to the I could talk about costumes all day.
I could too.
Let's talk about the other films though. So we have Power of the Dog being huge.
12 nominations.
12 nominations.
Right.
Number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two?
Dune with close second with 10.
That's a big surprise. In certain ways. It's up for best film, isn't it? And yeah, quite a lot of people have raised an eyebrow.
But not best director. And they're thinking, well, what? And you know why? The Peter Jackson effect. They're waiting for part two.
Ah.
Uh-huh. So calm down. Don't make any
strategic?
Bets.
Is it strategic?
I'm
sure. Yes. I thought that people just went to the cinema and looked at a film and thought, I like them. I'm going to nominate them.
Well, they do sometimes. The popcorn doesn't get in the way. But, you know, this is part two. So, you know, we're waiting for part two. So we're going to wait and see how well he does with that. What I thought was a big surprise, and it's been leading all season, is Belfast, Kenneth Branagh's biopic. Beautiful design, which didn't get nominated, unfortunately. But Belfast has 7 nominations. It's tied with West Side Story. And I found it really, really sentimental. The woman I saw at the screening that I saw was a BAFTA screening, and the woman next to me was crying. And I wasn't.
What does that say about you rather than the film?
It just says maybe I got a good night's sleep. I don't know. Hard to say. But a lot of people really love it. A lot of people don't like it. It didn't get a vital editing nod, so it might not actually get Best Picture, but it is certainly nominated. And then we're looking at the popular films. Spider-Man, the big runaway blockbuster, 1 nod for VFX. So Oscars, see, what's interesting about this year, and I wanted to structure this a little bit better, was it's a real divider between the new voters that were intaken just a few years ago and the old voters. For example, in the Best Actor and Best Actress categories, we've got nommed actors. We've got people that have either won or been nommed before, outside of Kristen Stewart's first-time nomination. And another thing is that there's very little overlap with the BAFTA. So it just goes to show you that the BAFTAs are coming apart from how the Oscar people are voting.
Why is that happening?
Different countries, different viewpoints. I mean, they couldn't have Kristen Stewart because of royal factors. And also things are just seen differently here. Americans like sentimentality a little bit more. And they also like safety. For example, we've got Will Smith, who's been nominated 3 times. He's also listed as producer here. We want, you know, we've got Bill Cosby. We want Will Smith. We want somebody, you know, who's going to be a positive role model. And Denzel Washington.
Tell us a little bit more about whether this is redressing the balance. You're talking about the new intake of voters.
Yeah.
Remember, you know, we all remember Oscars So White a couple of years ago. Is this being addressed?
Well, yes, it is being addressed. I mean, maybe not as strongly. For example, Ruth Negga didn't get a nomination, which we were all hoping that she'd get. But it's slowly, and also what they've done. I mean, the Critics Circle has also upped which I'm the secretary, also upped our intake of a more diverse critics. So I think across the board, and of course it scuppered the Golden Globes. But I think that is showing. But also, not only are we getting more diversity, we're also getting more international interest. So we've got Drive My Car. We've got Flea, which is an astonishing film. Even if you don't think you're interested in it, give it half an hour.
Why? Tell us a little bit more about it.
It's the story. It's a documentary, but it's also animated about a gay Afghan man who left and goes to Denmark to live. And it's astonishing because you think it's a cartoon, basically. It's animated, but it's a documentary.
Karen, one thing. If we had 3 films to watch between now and April, what would they be?
Ooh, okay. Okay. Come on, quickly. All right, okay. Power of the Dog.
Okay.
West Side Story.
Yep.
And Drive My Car.
Thank you very much indeed. Karen Krasanovich there in the studio. That's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers, Charlie Filmacord, Paige Reynolds and Emma Searle. Our researchers were Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Annabelle Martin. And our studio manager was Chris Blackwell, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. After the headlines, more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday in London, and The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.